This is The Takeaway, and I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. It's politics time, and we've got plenty to discuss. Washington is breathing a bit easier today because late Wednesday night, Democratic and Republican Senate leaders reached a deal to halt the government from defaulting, at least temporarily. The short-term debt ceiling increase is only good until early December. But in the one-day-at-a-time reality that is the new norm for our governance, congressional leaders are sounding triumphant for accomplishing the short-term fix.
We have reached agreement to extend the debt ceiling through early December, and it's our hope that we can get this done as soon as today.
Democratic members and staff negotiated through the night in good faith. The Senate is moving toward the plan I laid out yesterday to spare the American people a manufactured crisis.
Legislative action in the Capitol has a pretty short time horizon, but elected leaders are engaged in longer-term planning on one thing: midterm elections. More than a year out from November 2022, contested races in key states are already beginning to make headlines. Both Democratic and Republican leaders are strategizing, fundraising, gerrymandering, and prognosticating at a fevered pitch. All right, let's talk about it. We've got Michael Steele, former Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, previous chair of the RNC, and host of the Michael Steele podcast. Welcome back to the show, Michael.
Hey, Melissa. How are you? It's so good to be back with you.
It is so good. And, I totally want to rename your podcast Man of Steel podcast. But, we can totally talk about that later.
You know what? I have to tell you, that was the original name. But what we found was that people just got it confused with the actual Man of Steel. I was like, okay, that's complicated.
Yeah, let's just, right, fair enough. We're also here with Christina Greer from Fordham University, who is co-host of the podcast FAQ NYC and author of the book Black Ethnics, Rage, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream. Welcome back, Christina.
Thank you so much for having me.
Michael and Chrissy, this is for both of you. We've just been talking here about the debt ceiling, and we sent our young digital producer, Zach Bynum, out this week. We wanted him to talk to some folks, so he went around the NYU campus and basically asked people what they knew about the debt ceiling and how it affects them. I just want to take a listen to an answer that's pretty indicative of the kind of responses we heard.
For starters, I don't know what it means, but I'm assuming it's talking about the fact that, like, student debt is so high that, like, it's reaching, like, a ceiling that, like, it shouldn't be so high. You know what I'm saying?
So obviously that's wrong, but it occurs to me that people are not necessarily very invested in a debt ceiling fight. Michael, let me start with you, because I guess it's in some ways the Republicans have picked it. Why have this fight if people aren't even sure what they're fighting about?
That's why you have it. And the reason you have it is it's easier to purvey in confusion and to create a narrative that is not exactly historically or otherwise correct. And so, you know, when you're out here making claims that, you know, for example, the Biden administration needs to do this alone, well, that's never happened and it can't happen. You have to have a bipartisan resolution. One. Two, the idea that, the Biden administration, has to raise the debt ceiling to pay for its social engineering of the American economy. Well, that's just BS, because what raising the debt ceiling is to pay for the bills that were already created, meaning in this case, the $8 trillion that the Trump administration spent over its 4 years. So if you have a public that is not engaged in the facts around what this is and what it isn't, it makes it easier for a political operation to play out, where you just sow confusion and make it seem like this is a problem created by the other guy.
That is actually extremely helpful to think of, because I think we typically think, and Christina, I'm even thinking like political science, we think, okay, people take meaningful positions and they're trying to kind of position themselves relative to the political parties. But if it's actually better to have a fight about nothingness, then we don't even get to the big issues.
Absolutely, Melissa. I mean, think about this. We spent, what, a month, 2 months talking about critical race theory out of nowhere instead of talking about the hundreds of thousands of Americans who have died because of COVID and the ineptitude of Republican leadership. So the Republican Party has mastered this bait and switch that Democrats oftentimes follow along and play along with. But we have to understand that it's really them creating these nothing burgers for the public to argue about and think about without a real conversation about what exactly is going on. And so as we know, the stakes are so high, the Republican Party is really invested in a lot of confusion to make sure that they're never held accountable for a lot of their policy positions. Because when we look at public opinion, we see that the country is going in a direction that consistently moves farther and farther away from the Washington, D.C. Republican elites.
You know, what people really do understand, though, is jobs. And Friday job numbers came out. They're pretty disappointing. Economy added 194,000 new jobs in September. That is way down from 366,000 in August and more than a million in July. You know, I'm wondering, Christina, if there's only sort of so long that Democrats or Republicans can have a nothing burger, because people will notice in December if they don't have enough money to buy holiday gifts and pay those student loans.
Absolutely. I mean, Melissa, you know, you and I as political scientists know that people go to the polls based on their economic circumstances. That's what they vote about. You know, lots of folks are like, oh, Latinx populations vote based on immigration. Absolutely not. They vote just like everyone else, pocketbook issues, and do you have enough money for you and your family to move forward? And I think the larger issue with the Democratic Party has always been, even with their successes, they are not great at articulating to the American public what they have done, how they have rescued the American public from horrid Republican policies that have almost pushed us off an economic cliff. And so even if Americans don't have as much money as, say, they want or need or had a few years past, the Democratic Party needs to explain to the American public what exactly it is they're doing to make sure that there's a foundation being laid so people can actually have jobs moving forward if they don't have them right now.
So, Michael, I'm interested as we're thinking about this, like, big questions here around the material circumstances of ordinary Americans, as we're thinking about these, you know, these sort of DC fights that nobody even knows what the fights are about. And I got to say, I absolutely thought that at the end of the Trump term, that we were going to see an all-out battle for the soul of the Republican Party, that this was like the moment when we were going to see which Republican Party was going to come into ascendance and whether it was going to be one that was really kind of on these issues or one that was going to, you know, take, you know, questions like, for example, critical race theory to talk about. Right. Is that battle happening and I just don't see it because I might not be seeing it? Or is it seated? Because I see the fight happening in the Democratic Party. Is it happening in the Republican Party?
No, in large measure, no, it's not. 75, 76, 78% of the base of the Republican Party are stuck on Trump. And we know, you certainly know, as both of you as professors, when you have someone in your class who's stuck on stupid, you realize there's very little that, you know, you might as well just give them the grade down and move on because it ain't going to work. And that's where we are in the party. I mean, there are those of us who are trying to carve out. In fact, I got into a little bit of a debate with a buddy of mine, and he just kept pressing, why are you still a Republican? You know, if all of this is going on, why are you still a Republican? I said, well, because I want to, you know, there's a handful of us who want to stay inside with the light that says this is what democracy is about. This is what the Republican Party of Lincoln was about. These are the things that we still value and stand for. It's easy to blow the light out and leave. A lot have done that. There's some of us who want to hold that standard up because whatever iteration Republicanism takes in the future, we feel this is an important part and feature of it. And so we don't want to, while this form may pass, I mean, we remember the Whigs, right? Yeah, no, we don't. They're gone. That may pass. Something better has to replace it. And that's what the battle lines are being drawn around right now. You're going to see some of that, Melissa, in the upcoming election cycle. You have candidates that are emerging like Evan McMullen in Utah, who you know, is running as an independent for the U.S. Senate to, you know, former Republican presidential candidate in the 2016 cycle, you know, who are trying to reestablish the guardrails. And I think you're going to see more and more candidates like that. There is a groundswell of support, by the way, for Liz Cheney, not just in her own district in Wyoming, but across the country. So it's happening in pockets, but it is happening.
And look, to be fair, that question, why stay in the Republican Party, isn't really a bad question to also ask of Democrats, right? Particularly maybe of Black Democrats, why stay in the party, or of progressive Democrats? And so, Christine, maybe I'll just come to you on this about what is a very apparent public battle within the Democratic Party right now. And I'm wondering, because I think our sense is if you're fighting internally, that weakens the party going into the midterms. But is there a way to understand it as potentially strengthening the party going into the midterms?
Yeah, I mean, Melissa, I'm oddly on a weird optimism kick these days, but
what?
I do think.
Wait, did you go on vacation or something? What do you mean?
I think I'm just trying to be like a plant and lean towards the light. But I think it's good to have productive policy debates in an intra-party way so that the Democratic Party can articulate a longstanding vision. Now, if these fights and debates become petty and too longstanding and the American public feels as though there's too much navel gazing and internal fighting and not enough outward projection as to what the party is going to do for its members, then we've moved into a non-productive realm. But for right now, I think when you have sort of the progressive wing that is significant within the Democratic Party, by no means the majority, and then you have a more moderate and centrist faction of the party that represents, quite honestly, millions of Americans and the vast majority of Black Americans, they're trying to have substantive debates and conversations to figure out the best policy. And we know that all things in American politics are rooted in compromise. And so no one is going to get their absolute 100% wish list. This is a time for them to flesh these things out. Now, as we get closer to primaries and election day, we need to solidify what exactly it is this party is doing for the American public, not just the Democratic Party, but just for the American public. The issue, as I said before, with the Democratic Party is even when they have wins and successes and the compromises being made, they still don't know how to articulate it to the American public to show the progress that's being made.
Mike, I want to come to you on Mike Pence. He was at one point a very clear critic of the people who attacked the Capitol on January 6th. But this week on Fox News suggested that the day was exaggerated by media. And I'm just wondering again, like, why? Like, he was sort of a hero of that day in a weird way. And now he's adjusting his stance.
It is a reflection of the toxicity of Trumpism. And the very unique attribute of wanting to somehow please this man, not be on his bad side or his wrong side, needing him to validate your political existence, which is the most incredibly stupid way to do politics. But Mike Pence, who showed himself to be a true sycophant as vice president, even in the face of the president essentially sicking his followers and supporters on him during the riots, still now finds himself trying to mitigate that and explain it away and to make excuses and lie about it. And that tells you he's looking to run for president in 2024. He doesn't want to have Trumpists against him. And so this is the narrative that you see play out, and you'll see and hear more of it over the next 18 months.
Look, if there is sort of one person or set of people we are supposed to be absolutely beholden to in the context of a democracy, it's the people, right? The voters. And Christina, obviously this one of the central questions moving up to the midterms and well beyond around the health of democracy is voting rights. And, you know, for a while, kind of lots of noise around the voting rights bills. I'm wondering where they stand right now. And if, you know, again, if the voters themselves can be a corrective to this madness.
I don't know, Melissa. I mean, we know that that's one of the policy issues on the vice president's plate, along with immigration, border control, vaccine hesitancy, and police reform, and so much more. I do think that we really do need to rely on an insider-outsider approach when it comes to voting rights. We need to sort of stay on our elected officials with protest politics, not just in Washington, D.C., but also on the state house levels, to make sure that it's a multi-pronged approach. We know that the Republican Party is really invested in making sure that they roll back all types of voting rights. We know that in 13 different states, we've got proposals in the state house to do just that. But we also know that there's some mealy-mouthed Democrats that are not as assertive as they should be with making sure that in this Democratic Republic, all citizens have free and fair elections.
If there is a critical public social issue that has divided the parties now for several decades, it is the question of abortion. And the Texas abortion law is obviously one that goes to a space we've never seen previously, not only in terms of restrictions, but in terms of deputizing ordinary citizens to actually enforce the law. This week, we saw a temporary block by a federal judge on the state's ban, and state officials quickly filing appeals. I'm wondering, I'll start with you, Michael, and then I want to come to you, Christina, sort of how you think this battle over abortion in the state of Texas, but clearly much more than that, is going to play out again as we are going into the midterms. How much will this dominate our conversations?
It's going to be a dominant issue, and it's going to be dominant because of the case that's before the Supreme Court now in Mississippi, I believe, that effectively looks to gut Roe versus Wade. The Republicans have been trying in the latter half of the last 10 or 15 years trying to figure out strategies to do just that. They think they have found the formula, and they're going to pursue it through the courts. There's the reason why McConnell held the line on Supreme Court nominations the way he did, going back to Merrick Garland, because that was a big part of the strategy. It's one of the things, Melissa, you and I used to talk about this when we were colleagues at MS, and that and that was the Supreme Court. Y'all pay attention to the Supreme Court, because Republicans were very obvious where their target was. And I think you're now seeing that play out, and you're going to see more of that coming from the states. And the Texas law, as someone who is pro-life, and that's all the way, I'm anti-death penalty, pro-human beings, right? Living life.
You're Catholic. That's right. Natural life to natural death. Right.
Exactly. And this law is an abomination. To put a bounty on the wombs of women, to take away their strip away their choice, which is now safeguarded by the Constitution, is unfathomable. And I think the responses by citizens are going to matter a lot going into next year.
Christina, I want to let you weigh in as well.
Yeah, a few things, Melissa. One, I mean, there's no such thing as pro-life. It's either pro-choice or anti-choice. And so what we're seeing is the Republican Party really moving towards a conversation to take away choice from millions of women in America. Two, all the Gallup polls and Pew Research is showing 60% of Americans say that abortion should be legal. So the Supreme Court and the Republican Party, again, are not in lockstep with the American public. I agree with Michael. This is going to be an issue that moves bodies to the polls. I think a lot of women are looking at not just their own choices, but the choices of their daughters. The beauty and the curse of, you know, American democracy is that we have progress and regress. And so we thought that this literally was litigated in 1973. And we know that conservative members of the Republican Party have been working diligently for about 50 years to roll this back. We're seeing, you know, it pop up in states all across the country. And so it's really up to us to keep the pressure on our local, state, and national elected officials to make sure that we don't have these sort of weak bills that protect a woman's right to choose. We have to sort of be full-throated in our agendas and really thinking about the courts, not just the Supreme Court, but, you know, in many states you vote for various judges, and really keeping an eye on your elected officials who appoint other justices. So we know that even in the lower courts, a woman's right to choose isn't taken away.
Christina Greer is Associate Professor of Political Science at Fordham University, co-host of the podcast FAQ NYC, and author of the book Black Ethnics. Michael Steele is the former Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, the former chair of the RNC, and host of the Michael Steele podcast. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
It's such a pleasure to be with you again, Melissa. Really enjoyed the conversation.